because when we think about what the Montgomery bus boycott represented in what we now definitively refer to as the civil rights movement, nobody questions whether or not it's a movement, but whatever that set of feelings you have are, whether it's shame, embarrassment, anger, whatever it is.
Fatigue.
That is enough. That is enough motivation. So you don't have to convince yourself that it could be worse. Like, whatever you feel is actually enough. It was enough for prior groups of people to say, we're going to do something about it. We're going to create change. We're going to do our part in this tiny southern city to create enough change that would have a ripple effect across the country. And I think that's the way that I look at it. And so when people question whether or not FIRE is a movement, I say, not only do I think it's a movement, I think it's arguably the most important movement of this time because it has the potential to unlock other movements. You need financially independent people if you expect to see progress in our political environment, and if you expect to see progress in diversity, equity, and inclusion, if you want to see people moving forward with protecting families, public education, etc. You need people who are not solely motivated by their own interest, and that's what financially independent people are.
This is a non-violent protest. We are depending on moral and spiritual forces using the method of passive resistance.
Yes.
Where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Julian.
And I'm Kirsten.
And today's episode, I think right off the bat, is going to be a little different. We're talking about the FIRE movement. We're asking a rather big kind of abstract question, whether or not the FIRE movement is a movement at all, which might sound odd since it's called the FIRE movement. But we'll get into why we are asking that question. And then I think there's going to be quite a bit of really rich dialogue around our beliefs and where we think it's going, why we think it matters. And we're going to unload a lot of facts and a lot of information on you guys. And so buckle up. Black History Month is oftentimes a time of reflection. So we're going to do a little bit of that as well. And I can't make any promises. I think this is going to be a passionate conversation. I don't know what's going to happen. I might get.
I mean, we have notes, but
we do have some notes.
Might go a little rogue.
We might get a little heated because it's a passionate subject for us in many ways.
I think I wanted to talk about this because of exactly what you said. Black History Month is a period of reflection, and now at my big age, I'm on my. It's been dozens of Black History Months, and I have been studying Black history. I've been taught Black history since I was old enough to walk. I'm pretty sure I knew the Negro National Anthem before I knew the actual national anthem. But when you are immersed in a subject for that long, and when it's told by the people who actually experienced it, you start to pick up on some patterns.
Yeah.
And one of the patterns that I've picked up on, and that I think most Black people have, is this tendency to revise history, this tendency to sugarcoat the story. Like, we talk about Martin Luther King, and, you know, we just celebrated King Day. It's a national holiday. But we don't talk about how Coretta had to fight for that to happen and how she had to literally, you know, engage Stevie Wonder, one of the biggest artists of the time, to make it happen. We certainly don't talk about the fact that he didn't just die. He was killed. He was assassinated. He was an enemy of the state, all because he was the face of something that we all believe is natural and normal and the right thing to do. Yeah. It seems pretty reasonable now. But in 1968, it didn't. It was, his approval rating was in the trash. And a third of Americans thought that he deserved his assassination. He brought it on himself.
Yeah.
And so I think we tend to forget how quickly the world bends itself around a vision that doesn't necessarily exist. We tend to just skip over the fight and the progress that needs to happen in the interim. And then in hindsight, we call it a movement when it's natural to our children.
Yeah, I agree. As I think about my own indoctrination into Black history. You know, when I think about my own experience and my formative experience in learning about the civil rights movement and Black history, which was really in the fifth grade, and it just kind of changed me. It stuck with me. And my relationship with studying Black history has changed quite a bit over the years. I still appreciate it. I view that period differently. But I think to your point, now that I am, you know, I'll say it, I'm 43 years old. I'm at a different point where I am a bit more focused on progress and making sure that I do my part to experience more progress than constantly regurgitate wins or even celebrate firsts today that I think should have been firsts decades ago.
Yeah. And I, you know, that's another tendency is that we talk about these movements as if they have definitive start and end dates. But the reality is we are still fighting for civil rights.
Still fighting, yeah.
We are still making Black history. There is a first Black something every other week. And so to be able to be present, to know enough about where we are on the world clock, on the world timeline, is a really important. And I think that our intention with this episode is to put where we are on the economic progress scale into context, and to also put some of the backlash against FIRE into the appropriate historical context.
Yes.
Because while race is something that is very visible, it's kind of shallow, you can just kind of quote unquote see if someone is a darker complexion person or a lighter. Economic progress is a lot harder to measure. You really have to be intentional about looking for the sparks and the changes and stringing them all together to say, you know what, is this a movement? Like, things are changing.
Yeah. So I want to start there. And I want to start to unpack this issue. It is admittedly a complex issue. When we talk about FIRE, you can look at it from a number of ways. We have categorized them into, I think, three different categories. So we're going to explore some financial indicators, some work and career related indicators, and close out maybe discussing some of these social indicators that I think really make not just the case for change, but also help us say, yes, without question, we are experiencing a movement of sorts right now. I want to start with financial indicators. And there are several. We are cherry picking those that I think fit more so for the conversation and the point that we're particularly trying to make.
And the ones that have just happened in like the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, we could go all the way back to the Great Resignation. We could go back to a number of places, but let's just focus in the spirit of being present while history is being made.
Yes.
Focus on the ones that, you know, happened in the last couple of weeks.
So the first one that I will start with was based on a report that was issued in the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal is obviously one of the most widely respected national news publications with respect to the financial markets. And it was an article that basically said that Black investors were the biggest new group of stock buyers. And I'll be honest, you know, you just a couple minutes ago, you said something around economic indicators, and it brought me back to my college class. I unfortunately do not remember the professor's name, but he asked a really big question, one that woke me up because it was an 8 o'clock class. And he asked whether or not the civil rights movement was successful. Mm. And everyone, just by default, to your point, because we've been regurgitating these points, said, yes, of course it was. And he asked and started laying down some of the financial indicators to say, well, maybe it was, except for the lack of progress that we've made economically. And obviously, if you've read our book, then you know how we feel about Black wealth. And we start the book talking about a particular study that really shook us to our core. For me to read this article and to know that it was led by Gen Z and them embracing technology and embracing fintech and embracing cryptocurrency, now to be the biggest group of stock buyers now in 2024, was probably one of the brightest lights and brightest indicators of progress that I could think of in my 43 years on this earth.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you think about the mix of Black wealth. Part of the reason why we experience such a deep and growing racial wealth gap is because a lot of Black wealth is tied up in their homes. It's illiquid, and the home market doesn't grow at the same pace or rhythm as the stock market. And so we don't benefit from bull runs the same way that our counterparts do. And so to see that Gen Z has taken that knowledge and decided to do something different is really encouraging.
I think you're being kind. I would say that real estate as a whole is a leakier bucket
100%.
Of wealth than the stock market. And I also am brought back to a particular article I remember. And in the article, what she was highlighting was that around half, I believe, of Black wealth was lost in the housing market. So much of our wealth was tied up in home equity. And yes. as a result, around half of it was lost. And obviously it was concentrated in certain areas like mm-hmm. in Atlanta and mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C. and New York and some of the other places where Black people are concentrated. When I see this rise of Gen Zers embracing newer ways of building wealth, I see it in some ways as an act of rebellion.
Yeah.
And in some ways as a drawing of the line and saying, you know what, mom, dad, auntie, uncle, you guys have been doing it your way, and this is where it's gotten us. Mm-hmm. We're going to embrace a new way of building wealth, a better, more efficient way, a less discriminatory way of building wealth. And I think that's something that I'm really, really proud of. And so shout out to Gen Z and really anyone that's really been embracing stock investing and mutual funds and all of the things that I think contribute to economic empowerment here in the United States.
And shout out to all y'all who sent us that article. I think I received it from a couple dozen people. Were just like, you know, y'all,
you're
for
doing good work. No. You're doing good work. I saw this article and I thought of you guys. And because you're right, it did not pop up on mine. I got it as a DM from a woman on Facebook. So that's one indicator. The second one, I think, is really the headline story of the stock market as a whole, just kind of following along in that same vein. And we're coming off. It's an interesting thing, right? Because like we just experienced the greatest bull market in U.S. history, 2009, this initial bounce back from the Great Recession of 2008. From 2009 to 2020, we saw the greatest sort of return to stockholders.
Talk about resilience.
If you were invested before then, you did very, very well. If you stayed the course, you did very, very well. It all kind of comes to a screeching halt in March of 2020 when the pandemic hits. And I think it lost around 26% in 4 days, something to mm-hmm. that effect. Like it was a deep cut in yeah. a very short period of time. If you were an investor, you bounced back very quickly, probably yeah. quicker than you would have ever experienced for those of us who've been investing for over a decade or so. Like you expect recessions to hit a little harder. And that one was almost like a hiccup. And so on top of this incredible bull run from 2009 to 2020, you've got a bit of a hiccup in 2020. And then the S&P 500 says, hold my beer.
Rally.
I can do even better. And so here we are in 2024, hitting new highs, which almost seems like every other day. Now, think about that from a perspective of a have not. Someone who was not invested, right? Someone who is looking back and watching all of this money flowing in parts of the city or parts of the country, parts of the world where you are not. Mm-hmm. You are still where you are. You're still in 2008, 2007. Mm-hmm. You're still trying to claw back from losing that job or someone in your family losing that job or whatever it is.
Or you're still using your savings account and you're watching the power of the dollar, the strength yeah. of the dollar decline because of inflation.
Yeah.
And so while $5,000 was a ton of money back in 2008,
yeah.
now, you know, it's enough to cover rent and groceries for the month. And yeah. so you're realizing that you're on the wrong side of the coin. And even just for the, you know, not even for the have-nots, for the have-not started, for the Gen Zs
sure.
who are going into the workplace with this understanding of where they should put their money, the purpose of income, of working, of investing in a very different way.
Yeah. And I think what it highlights are a couple of things. And I guess this is on both sides of the coin. One is just the deep sense of disillusionment that so many people may feel, right? When you've watched other people's money compound faster than your ability to earn it
yes.
for a 15-year period, at some point you just start to say like, oh, I can't compete. I mean, you guys are literally making money in your sleep. You earned what takes me a year to earn without having to work,
mm-hmm.
right? That is something that I think a lot of people are experiencing right now. And I think it's affecting a lot of people's perspective on just about everything, whether or not they even want to live, work in this country anymore. And I think that's a major indicator. The other side of it is that when you are a beneficiary of that, it feels like, you know, to put it in a historical perspective and in the way that we view what we call the roaring 20s, right? Like this party time of just champagne and caviar and yacht trips and mm-hmm. all of these things. This is where we are. And I don't think a lot of people think of themselves that way. They just think that this is just how it is. We just happen to be living in boom times.
Exactly.
Of course, my half of my business is powered by AI. And of course, I've got cutting edge technology.
And of course, I can click a button and food show up at my doorstep.
Why wouldn't I be able
or
to
something
do that?
Be delivered in, 24 hours for free.
It's normal. Anyone can do it. All you have to do is download the app. Like, don't you have 4K, LTE? And it was like, no, actually 40% of the country still doesn't have high speed internet access.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so we are so removed and so separated from what's happening. Like, we talk about the haves and the have nots, but I don't think many of us have relationships with the other side.
Yes.
We don't talk enough. And so we don't really understand what the other side is experiencing. And I think it's just creating this incredible sense of disillusionment and frustration for a lot of people on the losing end of that equation.
And on the winning end, if you haven't put your money to work, if you've become victim to consumerism, as opposed to understanding the nature of our economic system and benefiting from the other side.
Yeah, yeah. I credit this last indicator to the FIRE movement for sure, right? And this is that finally, and for the first time in history, passively managed funds, the value of those funds, mutual funds and ETFs, have now officially amassed more than the value of actively managed funds. Before I go any further into that, if you are listening or if you're watching this and you don't know what that means, you have homework to do. We talk about this. It is a core part of the FIRE movement. It is an important lesson in our class, Making Money Grow. So if you don't understand why we are listing this and naming this and talking about it as a major, major indicator, I'm telling you right now, you have some homework to do. And so look up the difference between passive investing and active investing. If you want to learn more, we have a class called Making Money
Grow. And it's in our book. It's chapter 7.
And it's in our book.
Go
we
re-read
talk about it,
it
there
if
as
If you
well.
Didn't make it to chapter 7, incentive to keep reading.
This to me, I think, is another, not just sign of progress, but in many ways, an act of rebellion against the financial industry for sure. It's saying, hey, Warren Buffett was right. Jack Bogle, who created the first index fund, I believe in the late 1970s, was right. I think index funds just turned like 35 or something like that.
They're young.
So it took 35 years for this idea that no one can actually predict the market, that it's best to just bet on the market as a whole. 35 years, something like that, for the total of these passively managed funds to finally overtake the Goliath.
Yes.
That, like, they are now the Goliath.
Yes.
This idea of David and Goliath. You're not. David is a grown man.
Yeah,
now.
He them five rocks worked.
Listen.
He took them out.
He is there. It is such a powerful, powerful thing. And I think aside from that first article, when I saw that one, which again, this all of this happened to happen within about a week.
Yeah.
We got all this information. It's why it's top of mind. But those two things, I think, like, almost, I got choked up a little bit.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, I without question feel like I am on the right side of financial history.
Yeah. It's like if your side hustle starts making more money than your full hustle.
Correct.
Like, it's that kind of flip. That kind of paradigm shift where it's like, actually, I don't need a middleman.
Correct.
Right? That is what it's saying, is that more people can just invest in something that doesn't require anyone to do it on their behalf, anyone to manage the funds and the pool on their behalf, and still win.
Yeah, yeah. I want to stitch all of these together in a quick, succinct way. And I think for me, what this really means is, with respect to the FIRE movement, given passively managed funds is a core part of that movement, given, at least from the way that we look at it, that this is less of just a way of life and in many ways an act of rebellion. And so now knowing that this economically disenfranchised group of people in this country are now leading the way and saying, hey, we realize that this is the way to go, that this is an irrefutable path to progress, and we want to be at the forefront of it. To me, that's how I'm interpreting all of these things. And I think further cements the point that we're trying to make with respect to this is unquestionably a movement, but some people are applying it in ways that maybe others aren't.
I think in every movement, there are these sparks that don't get attributed to turning points in the movement until well after, and historians can see a shift in either psychographic, demographic, or economic data looking back. These things just happened in the last week, but I think inevitably there is a shift. There's enough of a shift for people to be reporting on it. So when you look at how it changes behavior in a year or two or five or 10 or 35, that's when you start to see that there are signs that this is a movement.
Yeah, I agree.
So those were the financial indicators, and they were pretty, you know, pretty substantial. I want to talk a little bit about the work indicators. Yeah. And I'm actually going to breeze past some of the ones that we saw in 2020 and 2021. You guys are welcome to go back and look at the catalog and our podcast. We talked about the Great Resignation. We talked about burnout. We talked about George Floyd. We talked about DEI. Those were all of the trends just 2 years ago. And those shaped a lot of the industry.
Yeah.
But what I want to talk about is engagement, which is arguably the most important metric that companies use to measure employee satisfaction.
Yeah, I almost want to pause for a second because, like, I don't know that everyone knows what engagement means, right?
But engagement is the score that you get after you take them little surveys at work. Like, yeah. when they force you, but then they ask you, like, did your manager force you to take this survey?
Yeah, it was like, no, but
it's like, don't put yes.
It was highly suggested.
It was highly suggested
that you participate in the engagement survey. But yeah, it's not, it's like employee satisfaction.
Yeah, yeah. And to be clear, the highest it's ever been was in the 40s. Like, yeah. It might have been 40%, yeah. Even. And it's just been declining ever since 2020, and companies basically furloughed or laid off or shut down or made them come into an office. It's just been declining. And right now it's at about 33%. And even that, we're not supposed to assume that people have been coerced. You already know that, like, even that is probably a generous inflated number.
No, I completely agree. And again, this, I think one of the things I want to make sure that we are doing personally, but also inspiring other people to do, is to just be honest, right? Like, it is an uncomfortable truth, but the reality is that that number is likely inflated, right?
Yeah.
Like, the people are just saying, yes, I am. And I've been there. I have certainly been there at least once where I have added numbers because I felt like, you know what, let me just be the one person that lists everything as a 5 or a 10.
Or because I
send a signal that everything is fine.
Everything's fine. I love Katie. I love Lisa. I love whoever. Like, and a lot of people compartmentalize. So they don't say, like, 5 relative to the other things that I really enjoy. It's like 5 relative to my last job.
Yeah.
Or 5 relative to my cousin's job, because at least I don't have to work a 14-hour shift. Like, you're not actually talking about how engaged you are. You're just filling out the form.
Yeah. And
even with that pressure, 70-something% of people are like, it sucks.
Yeah. Correct. They're fed up. They're being completely honest about it. And I'll even say from my own experience, I've been on the other side too. And it very much felt like nothing worked.
Right.
I could either be overly optimistic and paint this picture that everything is wonderful here and I love it, or I can be real and give very specific examples in the hope that that sent an indicator too, or maybe something's going to be done. And either way, it kind of felt like nothing happened aside from some sharp response in a short period of time to try to make people excited to help get the scores up, because for whatever reason, that's what executives were paying attention to.
Yeah.
And then everything just kind of fell back into being normal. I think engagement and employee satisfaction, whatever you want to call it, is low. It has historically always been low since they've been recording this. And however low it is always going to be inflated, which I think kind of paints a picture of just how miserable work and work culture makes us.
So Gallup actually started reporting on employee engagement back in 2000. So it's been about 24 years. And about 2 years ago, the government decided they were going to do something about it. They were going to look at this metric and see what it means. And so the Surgeon General, you may have heard of him, he's responsible for things like warnings on cigarettes and signs in bars that encourage pregnant women not to drink.
Yeah.
The Surgeon General actually issued a warning on workplaces and talked about how they increase the likelihood of depression, anxiety, and burnout.
Yeah.
Toxic work environments now have the same Surgeon General's warning as a pack of cigarettes. That is historic.
Yeah.
Just like cigarettes didn't have that sort of historic feeling the first year that they came out with it. You know, we had to have loads of evidence before we were even willing to admit that cigarettes were a carcinogen. And now to have a Surgeon General doing the same thing for workplaces, it's like, all right, well, we may not feel it. We not feel the ripples enough to actually want to do something about it for a couple of years. But it happened. It happened in our lifetime while we were probably watching like the Super Bowl or something. Like, what were you doing in 2022? I don't know.
Yeah, this was one of the things that was most shocking to me when I saw it, because in my mind, I reserved Surgeon General warnings for life or death situations, right? Like, you, if you do this, just know that you are playing Russian roulette
right.
with your life. And I remember feeling that way towards my end of my career, literally feeling like this is actually far more serious than I'm not just complaining about the environment. I'm telling you that I'm feeling physically ill in this environment. And I think I was, you know, writing it off and saying, but there's no way, like that it couldn't possibly be that. But then I started doing some research and reading about it. I remember reading a book by a professor in Stanford. I cannot remember his name, but the book is called Dying for a Paycheck. And it without question helped me. I think his name is Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer, if I'm not mistaken. And if you haven't read that book, I highly recommend it. We've also spoken about this in our other podcast, which is a derivative of our book. It's the Cashing Out podcast. We have an entire episode dedicated to mental health and mental wellness. We talk about the Surgeon General warning. And I remember reading about it and thinking that there's no way, like surely we're going to do something about this. But to your point, we were in a state of entertainment drunkenness when it happened.
Yeah.
And so we didn't quite remember that this was issued. I remember we did a talk in Washington, D.C., in collaboration with the Urban League, and we dropped it on people. I remember one of the guys afterwards saying, like, clearly I need to read more. Yeah. And
it's like, how did I miss that?
But that's how I would feel.
Yeah.
If I were part of a work environment and didn't realize that the government had issued a warning about toxic workplaces. For as many people as we know that call their workplaces toxic, they did not realize that the government was saying, yeah, it's really bad for your mental health and is one of the leading contributors to anxiety, burnout, and depression. So you should probably be mindful of that. And then the U.S. government, because they can't stop it because we're in a capitalistic system, said, hey, man, like, here are some guidelines that you should follow. Not here's a penalty for people who have, like, imagine that if there was just a mandated engagement score and say, hey, if your scores are below this number, you are a company or an employer in the red zone.
Yeah.
And if you are, you need to pay X amount premium to your workers to cover any additional mental health or physical health ramifications that they may be experiencing by working for your company, right? That
Absolutely.
To me is an actual response. And I'd like to see our government step in and say, hey, like, there's a little bit more to be done than just issuing a warning. We need to start hitting people where it hurts and making sure that we're helping those people who have already been negatively impacted by this for decades to say, hey, here's some resources, here's some tools, here's some money that you're going to use or need to find the help that you need so that you can heal from the trauma that you've been experiencing under our watch.
And I think that's the interesting thing about movements is because we tend to talk about them as if they're siloed and individualistic, but they actually overlap and create offshoots of each other. So the labor movement is doing exactly and fighting for exactly what you're saying. They're fighting for additional wages. They're fighting for breaks. They're fighting for companies to mandate that list of recommendations within the job itself.
Yeah.
And that's part of their work. And I think that's really important to acknowledge that when we see that there are gaps, know that there are people creating movements, whether they're political or social, like I would call fire, to counteract and to get people on board with resisting the status quo in some way.
I don't exactly know what progress looks like, but when we start to look at other things that we know are well-documented risks, very similarly, when you're looking at a job description and it says, hey, if you sign up for this job, just know you're going to be liable
lifting heavy things.
Something that is at least 50 pounds. You're saying you can do this, right? And
right.
you're waiving all rights in case you break a bone or break your back or something like that. I think we will likely start to see that built into the job description. I think that is some form of an indicator. Again, it's not saying, hey, we're not going to stop you from doing it.
Yeah.
If you want to do
it. Just like there are smokers' lounges. Drink,
you want to smoke, you want to do some of these recreational drugs, you can do that at your own risk. My job is to put a nice little warning sticker on and say, hey, this job, these jobs, this company could be hazardous to your health.
Yeah. All right. Last thing I'll say with work is around another version of a warning sticker or some sort of institutionalized body of work. And it's around the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
In 2023. So just last year, if you missed this.
I hoped you were going to talk about this because I know when you found it, your mind was blown.
Oh, my mind was blown because it's truly revolutionary. And I think a lot of people missed it because I haven't seen any of the women's groups and women's advocacy platforms talking about it and screaming about it the way that I have. But in 2023, the Nobel Prize for Economics went to Claudia Goldin. And Claudia Goldin has a lifetime of research around the gender gap in earnings, and she actually coined this called greedy jobs. Now, greedy jobs are the jobs that require people to prioritize their work commitments over all of the other aspects of their lives. So you think about, you know, these high earning positions, whether you're a physician or an attorney, you're in academia or in healthcare, you're supposed to prioritize your work over your spouse's, children's, friends, and sometimes even your own health. You're on call. You're expected to be there every time.
Vacations.
Absolutely.
Childbirth.
Yeah.
Grief.
Maternity, paternity, all that. None of that matters because you have this greedy job. And her research shows that greedy jobs and greedy work fuel the wage gap far more than bias does. And what her research finds is that in households where two parents or two people have a greedy job, they have a very difficult choice to make. Because in order to take care of all of the maintenance that life requires, one person has to be more available than the other. And in most cases, that person is still the woman.
Yeah.
So it is not skills, it's not education, it's not interest, it's not lack of confidence, it's not lack of negotiating skills that's driving this wage gap. It's the fact that we have constraints regarding work hours, flexibility, and family responsibilities. And more often than not, the woman is the one who takes the hit in terms of salary and in terms of performance at her greedy job. And so I just think that it is revolutionary that a woman won the Nobel Prize in Economics. The last Nobel Prize in Economics went to Ben Bernanke for what he uncovered about the bank's roles in the economy's collapse in 2008. And that work led to massive changes in governance around banks to prevent that from happening again. Last year, a woman won it for saying, listen, you can either be a high performer in your career or you can be a good parent, but you can't be both. Yeah. You gotta pick. And the best part about her work is that she's not blaming women. Because I always get to this point in my excitement and women start rolling their eyes like, oh, here we go. Now I can't be ambitious. That's not what she's saying at all. She's actually putting the pressure where it belongs, which is on corporate workplaces.
Yeah.
Workplaces need to reimagine their structure and their support systems for women. And when that is resolved, so is the wage gap. Like that is just it is just a chef's kiss of a body of work, and to have it recognized at the Nobel Prize level, which you know influences global economies,
for sure.
It influences academia, it influences a lot of the way that we do things because it is the highest honor, at least one of them, in this country.
Yeah, I think if the Surgeon General warning wasn't enough to get you, I think Claudia Goldin's research, and certainly in the context of Black History Month and thinking back to Dr. Martin Luther King, who was issued or given a Nobel Peace Prize for the work that he did, and how oftentimes those awards help set the stage for what is or what are the fights of our time.
Yes,
right?
And policy.
Like what are the real
fight
large
the Emmys and the Oscars.
Global reaching issues of our time. And I think that for me is one of the things that I thought was most profound about what she did. I did not hear much or anything really about it, aside from what you shared with me. And I remember thinking that that was highly unfortunate and low-key suspicious. but I also understand the state of the, you know, world that we're in. And I also understand that we come from a place of privilege and the ability to curate our media and to...
I was just about to say that. Finding progress is
It's actually, very difficult. And I think, you know... mapping it all up back to the point that we're making about fire and whether or not it's a movement, I think that this is, to me, just another indicator that it without question is, right? These things always tend to kind of happen in these tiny little pockets. And it takes those dedicated people typically a lifetime to keep beating a drum. And then you start to see large institutions like the government and the Nobel, you know, organization and all of those things to say, hey, this is really important. It's been proven. This is what we're doing. And that's what ultimately sets the tone for the next generation.
Right. All right. So if that wasn't enough, we've talked about financial indicators. We've talked about work indicators.
Yeah.
There are also still some social and cultural indicators as well. So I think I want to start with tech because to me, it's the lowest hanging fruit. I think for any movement to be successful, they need a means to communicate to the masses.
Yeah.
And before technology, we would use institutions. We would use colleges and churches and places where people govern, town halls and Main Street. You know, there's good old relics of community.
Yeah.
And today we use social media, we use hashtags, we use websites, we use apps. We're ending one golden era of technology, which was social media and the ability to create and contribute to what we now know is the internet. That's one era. And we're moving into AI, which is the ability to source that information as needed. But there's never been a better time for like-minded people to find each other and to communicate what they're doing. And so when you've got technology, which expands the communication, expands the reach of your message, coupled with fintech, which makes what you're saying that much more accessible, those two things coupled has created this new way of participating in what we used to have to like go into Workday and like reallocate your paycheck to go into your 401k. Like that's how we know investing is that you had to like chop off a piece of your paycheck before it hit your checking account.
Yeah.
And then you had to send it somewhere and wait versus now where you can just like do it while you're in line at Starbucks. Like you can round up a purchase and invest the difference.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of ways you can look at it. I think you're highlighting the ease that technology brings to our day-to-day lives relative to the way we may have been able to do something before. And I think the way that I think about it is much more around speed. It's both, not to, you know, discredit what you're saying, but it's speed as well. So it's like the way that you're doing things not only is going to be easier, but it's going to be really, really fast. And so when I think about that from the context of creating social change, in some ways, the pace in which we thought change would be adopted is going to be much faster in a tech-enabled world than it would have been even 10 or 20 years ago.
Yes.
And that to me, I think, you know, depending on your point of view, can either be really, really exciting or really, really scary.
Which is why you see some of the backlash and the attempts to discredit it. And I think it is ease and speed, but it's also accessibility.
For sure.
Because now, if I tell you investing is the way to go, and I drop a link in the caption, you can download that app and invest right now. It's very different than I tell you, like, we're going to march in 3 weeks and you need to figure out a way to get to Charlotte, North Carolina. Like that gap, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to leave your house.
Yep.
You don't have to take a paper check to an investment firm. You don't have to set up an appointment with a financial advisor. You don't have to wait until you get an account number before you make your first deposit. It happens instantly. And so that intervention of when you find someone who can talk directly to your problem, talk to you specifically about what you're trying to accomplish, and give you a ready-made solution that you have access to immediately allows it to spread much quicker.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing, right? Going back to one of the earlier points that we were making around Gen Z and Black Americans, they are in part because of fintech and technology, the leading group of stock buyers, because they are embracing these tools. They're not doing it the old way anymore. They're doing it through all of these other ways and they're doing it passively, right? They're just doing it. And it doesn't occupy nearly as much thought or energy as it did for us. It's just what they know.
Yeah.
And I think that's, for me, very, very exciting.
It reminds me of how, you know, it used to be illegal to have an interracial marriage or to date interracially. And that idea that it was illegal or that it couldn't be imagined that interracial relationships would be the norm lasted and still lasts quite a bit. Anybody who's in an interracial marriage will tell you they get stares when they walk around. And it lasted even though a lot of the biggest voices and biggest names in social progress were biracial.
Yeah.
People still could not imagine a world where that was the norm. And this is what I see right now, where it's like, even though this stuff is happening right now, like you talk to any young person, they will tell you, like, I'm not going to no bank. I'm not setting up no appointment. I'm not hopping on no phone. We can't imagine a world where that becomes the default.
Yeah.
And I think that's the core of all social progress. It becomes this process where you start to imagine a future that is very different than what you know to be true.
Yeah.
Movements actually disrupt what we believe about certainty in a way that nothing else does. And then I think last but certainly not least is this act of God, this pandemic, this thing that we could not have imagined. Yeah. I think every generation has a moment where it feels like the world is watching the same thing. And that went away for a little while. Like the last time I truly felt it was probably 9/11. But when we didn't have streaming and when television and radio were all the same programs, the world experienced something at the same time. When the pandemic came and it affected everybody because it was intangible and viral, like literally, not social media.
Oh, got him.
It was literally viral.
You just cut that.
Jeez. I'm not editing my dad joke out, but it felt like everybody experienced the same thing.
Yeah.
And that is a core part of a movement taking flight. The pandemic absolutely changed the psychology of how we think about our lifetime, like our time here. It changed the way that we think about work. It changed the way that we think about investing. It changed the way that we think about our health.
And it introduced habits that many of us did not take nearly as seriously
yes.
as we should have before.
Yes.
Right. And that to me, like going back to the core point that we're making in terms of like how things change, like, and in this case, how fear becomes the catalyst to introduce a new way of thinking,
yes.
a new habit that everyone just says is now the norm.
The
because
norm.
Because we got a little too close to all of this kind of falling apart. And as a result, this is going to be the standard. I will wash my hands.
Yeah. We're not going
back. More than I previously did. And there is no question. I will have sanitizer
yeah.
in my car
yeah.
so that every single time I leave the grocery store or leave the gas station, I have access and the ability to cleanse myself in some way to ensure that I don't suffer this issue. It makes me think about how many of the habits and the way of thinking and organizing and planning your home if you were an adult during the Great Depression
Correct.
Still exist today.
Yes.
The recipes that you cooked, the things that you did, the way that you organize your home, the things you absolutely will not do because you still remember a time where everything kind of seemed like it was going to fall apart and you weren't really sure if you were going to make it. That sets the tone in many cases for how you view the rest of your life. And it just doesn't change no matter how much money you
Period.
Get, no matter how nice the weather is outside, no matter how well the stock market is doing. And I think when we start talking about social change and trends and relating that to fire, so many of us came so close to the edge during that moment where we were truly and genuinely uncertain
yeah.
if we were going to make it. And I shouldn't even say we, because we didn't. But I remember when people were being allowed to go back to work in the midst of all of this uncertainty
Scared.
And how that might have made me feel. Like, again, I'm saying it from a place of privilege, but I remember thinking, would I have gone into work if
yeah.
I got that email from my boss? And I don't know. I don't know. I feel like
you wouldn't have had a choice if you were an essential
you
worker.
You would not have had a choice if you were essential
they
worker.
They had to work through the whole thing.
Which we have, I don't even think we've given ourselves,
we haven't.
And by we, I mean like the country, a time to just stop and think and say like, what was that?
What was that?
I think about the pandemic now and I'm more so bracing for the day that our son comes and asks us the question because he's got to do the equivalent of a book report and say, what were we doing? And I've got to show him and say, hey, well, we stayed home and I remember I used to wear gloves to go to the grocery store and I wasn't really sure how I was going to do it, but I figured that something was better than nothing. And then you did virtual classes for daycare, and then we sent you back, but we weren't really sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were systems in place, but we could see that they were kind of faulty mm-hmm. every single day, but mm-hmm. we did it anyway. We rolled the dice.
Yeah.
And I don't know that
we
a lot of us
did the best we could with what we knew at the time.
Yeah.
And we haven't processed it. That was going to be one of my next points, is that the government and the country, going back to revisionist history, is very good at distracting us. And we have not taken the time to process it. But I think that people who are still in it, and there is a good bit of people who are still in it, I'm going to focus on children and women, understand that this is a core memory, that this is going to be a turning point. Our kids are not going to forget how they were treated during this time, how stressed their teachers were, how scary it was to be a kid who's curious. They're not going to overcome all of the developmental delays that came from being removed from structured learning environment. And a lot of parents were struggling with balancing having their kids at home and having to also be present on Zoom.
Yeah.
Women took the hit on that. The she session is a very real thing. Droves of women left the workforce because the pressures of all of this was too much. Like, to decide between work and childcare and maintaining a household and keeping everybody safe. And it rolled back so much of the progress that we had made the last few decades that we still haven't. And I won't even get started about long COVID and its impacts. The research is just coming out that the burden on healthcare that long COVID will cause is similar to that of cancer or heart disease. Like, it is going to be the new cancer.
Yeah.
All because we couldn't sit still.
Yeah.
All because we were unwilling to just relax for a little bit and let this thing do what it needs to do.
Because we had to go to work.
Because we had to go to work.
Because we had to go to work.
Yeah. That's not going to be viewed well. I mean, it's possible that we could rewrite it, right? Like, it's possible that they could distract us with a lot of different things, but I just don't see our kids telling that story in that way. At least not my kids. I'm going to educate them the same way I was educated on on the real.
With the country truth.
With the country truth. All right. So I know that's a lot. I feel like if this was a boxing match, the status quo would be on the ropes and the ref would be like ringing the boxing bell, like ding, 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 ding.
That's you
enough.
Win.
That's enough.
Throw in the towel.
So if I were to sum all of this up, I would say, one, it's important to remember that something being massively popular is not necessarily the best indicator of a movement's success or viability relevance. Relevance. The second thing I would say, and we talk about this in our book, Cashing Out, there's a chapter called Freedom Starts in Your Mind. And in it, we explain that there is always this perception about how movements happen or how social progress happens. And it's this idea that it just appear. But the reality is, social progress is just a lot of individual people taking that first step to change their mind and address the tension with the status quo. Yeah. It happens individually, but eventually it spreads. And I think that's the case with fire. I think originally it started with some quirky folks who decided, like, they hacked a system, but it has benefited from multiple trends that now make it into something that is more resembling of a movement.
Yeah.
There's the bull economy, the 2008 recession. There's the creator economy and content creation in general, which allowed the message to spread across the world. There's the emergence of fintech, which allows it to be accessible in a way that it's never been before. There's new passive income streams that allow you to play with the balance in your portfolio. There's been the global pandemic that fractured the psychological safety contract between employer and employee. And then there's just been this general lack of leadership in government and in the institutions that we trust.
Yeah.
And so when employers abandon you and when government abandons you, it's completely reasonable to wonder, who else can possibly save you? And it's actually a quite liberating. And when we think about FIRE or financial independence today, we still think about it as a choice. But if you go back to what forms social norms, it doesn't feel like a choice. It doesn't feel like you get to choose when you have your first taste of liquor. Like, that is 21 years old. You don't feel like you get to choose when you start to drive a car. That's 16 years old in the United States. And with retirement, it's not going to feel like we get to choose whether we want to be financially independent or not. You don't have a choice.
Yeah.
The idea that jobs carry you all the way through until your old age and then take care of you at the end is not going to be a shared story. It's not a shared story now, but it's certainly not going to be a shared story in another decade.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, even if you just think about what a movement is, and this is Julian's definition of it, you really just need two components. You need one part, which is what are we fighting against? And I think we've outlined quite a few of those things. I think there's the growing power imbalance between employers and employee, which is eroding quality of life, which is eroding family structure and eroding people's abilities to build wealth, because there's a built-in incentive for companies to pay workers less, right? And to extract as much value from them as possible, despite any of the long-term implications that that process might have, or even our willingness as employees to accept these terms, right? So there's that. And then on the other side, you've got the group of people who are organized in doing something about it. And I think, you know, just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen so many really clear indicators that, yeah, there is a group of people. Now, granted, there's also a group of people who say, I don't like this. There are
always
major, major platforms that discredit the FIRE method or the methodology or the movement, the community. They discredit it. There's an entire group of contrarian financial experts who discredit the approach, despite all of the evidence saying that this is actually a preferred and a more efficient way of investing your money than any of these other ways that make the financial services industry a boatload of money, but don't necessarily fund or contribute efficiently to the retirement accounts of actual investors. Then you've got people who I think are the old guard, if you will.
Yeah, they did it the traditional way.
They don't quite
understand the problem.
Any of these other things that people are complaining about. But I think, you know, at its core, you still have a pretty strong, growing, thriving, and global community of people who say this is a way of life and a way of investing that I think arguably has very little flaws, right? Like, it's not perfect. There are certainly some downsides to it, but that's to be expected in a complex environment.
Right.
But you can pick and choose the parts of it that work for you, the parts that you really want to double or triple down on. And I think those two things exist. You've got what you're fighting against, and then you've got an organized group of people who are working to take that thing down or dismantle all of this all of this stuff on the other side. And I think those two things alone, without question, validate that, yes, this is a movement. And I think it deserves the credit that it's gotten, certainly just in the last 5 years, in terms of the progress and normalization of the language and the approach to getting things done. So I know we used to do final thoughts. I feel like you've already made your point.
I've made several.
You've made several
drop
points.
The mic. I will. Times. And I expect y'all to tag me and validate me and tell me that, like, yeah, girl, you said that.
You broke it down so that it's forever.
Forever and consistently broke.
Yes. I do want to offer a final anecdote and maybe a little thought. We'll see what comes out of it. But as we were preparing for this podcast and this discussion, I opened up one of my favorite books. And I tend to do this every year. I'm starting to realize around January and February, as I get pretty introspective with respect to Dr. Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. And one of the things that I really enjoy doing is actually reading the speeches instead of relying on the clips that you see in social media, because it always unlocks something that I don't feel like I knew before.
Right.
And I think it also helps you to really thoroughly understand what he was fighting for. And it helps me better understand the moment that he was in every single case. And today I actually read something with respect to the Montgomery bus boycott, which is obviously one of the most popular and renowned acts of nonviolence that led to social change. And I would say, without question, is a turning point in the civil rights movement, for sure. It arguably defined it. It's the one that most people refer to.
Absolutely.
When they talk about it. And there was a particular speech that Dr. King shared with the congregation in Montgomery, I want to say, at the beginning stages of this boycott. And he was laying the foundation for why he felt this was an important movement and this was an important act. And in some of his opening statements, he starts talking about the percentage of Black people that had agreed to boycott the buses. And he said 99%. I don't know if that's an accurate number or not, or if he was just saying the vast majority of the people in the city have decided it. But as he started laying the case for the rationale for why they were doing it, He didn't talk about violence. He didn't talk about economic disenfranchisement. He just said embarrassment.
He just said embarrassment.
He said they were just tired of being embarrassed. They were tired, and this tiredness had just reached a tipping point where they just said that enough is enough. And I thought that was so important. And I kind of stopped there because I think what it did for me was it just go to show that like that was enough, that that is enough. And I certainly know, given how many people, we just recorded an episode a few weeks ago about layoffs, feel embarrassed after being laid off. They feel embarrassed because maybe before they were laid off, they considered themselves vocal advocates for their companies. They felt a kinship.
A loyalty. A love
in many cases. I know people who have used that word with respect to their employers and that relationship. They love their coworkers. They love what they do. They love their job. And then they get laid off and that love is severed. Mm-hmm. And the company goes on to do great things and it is what it is. I think the point that I'm making here is that whatever you feel is enough and worthy of being the seed to start a movement.